Hello everybody, Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, coming to you as usual from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. And today I am very pleased to welcome back to the programme the author Philip Kraske, who joined us a couple of years ago to talk about his book, which had the very intriguing title 11-9 and the Terrorist Who Loved Bonsai Trees. And if you'd like to hear that particular conversation, you'll find that in the TMR archives as number 226. But today, a different book, his new novella and collection of short stories entitled A Legacy of Chains and Other Short Stories. Philip Kraske was born in Detroit, spent his formative years in Ohio and Minnesota, graduated from the University of Minnesota with a bachelor's degree in international relations, and since the 1980s has been living in Madrid, teaching English and writing, often on political matters, and in recent years branching out into the authoring of novels. Phil, welcome back to TMR. Good to be speaking to you again.
Yeah, good to talk to you again, Julian.
Absolutely. Well, as I say, we're going to be chatting about this new book of yours, A Legacy of Chains and Other Short Stories, you kindly sent to me. And as I said to you before the interview began, I actually did very much enjoy reading this, not just because of the political, conspiratorial type themes, but also because of the variety, actually, in the political comment, obviously conspiracy speculation, quite a lot of humour. And even some titillation in parts, quite enjoyable, an interesting read. Anyway, we'll do all that in just a moment. But first, let's introduce you to listeners who didn't hear the last chat that we had. Could you tell us a bit about yourself, why you're in Spain, why you write?
Well, let's see. I studied in Spain my third year of university, which would have been back in 1980, back in the good old days before cell phones. Then after graduating and after spending about a year and a half in South America, I returned to Spain because I liked it so much. And also, if you're from Minnesota, which is one of the coldest places in North America, Spain has a certain attraction. So I've lived here continuously since 1985, married and have a daughter, and now I have grandchildren. And I've always been writing one thing or another. It sort of runs in the family. My father wrote nonfiction books for children, and my brother is a reporter, or was a reporter for the Kansas City Star. Now he just has a radio program there, and he teaches journalism at the University of Kansas. So writing kind of runs in the family. And in the early 2000s, I turned to writing novels, and starting in 2009, self-publishing my novels, because it's almost impossible to get into the publishing game these days. And since then, I've published six books. The last one is a novella combined with six short stories. And, well, I haven't sold millions of copies, but I've sold quite a few. And that's always been very gratifying to me and received a lot of good comments, a lot of good reviews.
And of course, with this and the previous book that we talked about, the 11-9 and the Terrorist Who Loved Bonsai Trees, etc., you are writing on political matters, but you're writing through fiction about political matters. Is that just a natural progression from the fact that you already write novels, or did you set out and say, oh, no, that's the way, a really effective way of doing it?
I started writing political commentary and things like that, but I found it a bit disappointing because there are so many people putting in their political two cents. And I've always liked to write fiction. And so I turned to fiction in politics because I feel that it explains a lot more than just political commentary. Political commentary, you might say, is looking at the trees, and political fiction is looking at the forest. And especially because I live in Spain and can look at America from abroad and say, well, what are the basic issues here? What's really important?
Yes. So being abroad for that length of time as well does give you a bit of a different perspective from many people, which is interesting to tap into when reading this. I noticed also looking at your website that you're very keen on the rhyming couplet. You have some quite amusing rhyming couplet style poems there. Quite cheesy. I quite like that. What's that all about? Why did you do it like that?
Yeah, most political commentary is this sort of very turgid stuff, a little bit hard to read. And I turned to writing, well, I don't know if I would call it poetry. I don't really consider myself in the same class as Robert Frost or somebody like that. I write couplets, just sort of making a small point about this and that here and there, doing it with some humor. And I found that I get a great response from that. I publish most of my poetry, you might say, both on my website and on opednews.com.
Oh, yeah.
And on Op-Ed News, I normally get 1,000 reads for every verse that I write.
Hmm.
It's sort of just a lot of fun that I like to do.
Yeah, fun. And also you can get some good points across by using humor. I'm a great fan of humor. I think it's a very powerful tool. And I'm also a bit of a fan of rhyming couplets because my mum used to write pantomimes in that style many, many years ago. Okay, let's talk then about the main part of the book. So the novella called A Legacy of Chains, in which you, I'm going to say, you imaginatively delve into the world of a conspiracy, kind of a conspiracy of silence by both the Vietnamese and US governments, allegedly, about American prisoners of war left behind in Vietnam for many years after the end of the Vietnam War. So could you give us a brief summary of the story, just sort of whet people's appetite about this, sort of crafted around those events, isn't it?
All right. Well, we have to start in 1973 when the war ended. And there was an exchange of prisoners. And in Washington, there was widespread shock when the Vietnamese only sent back 600 men. In Washington, they had expected well more than 1,000, probably closer to 2,000. Mm. Then the Vietnamese very quietly put out the word that when Washington pays up the war reparations that were promised in the treaty, that they will release the rest of the men. Hanoi had done the same thing with the French at the end of the Indochina War, which ended in 53. The French were paying for their men for about 20 years, but they got their men back. Washington, on the other hand, didn't pay. I think they were sort of expecting the North Vietnamese to say, well, we can't keep these guys forever and just send them back. But they didn't. They kept them. And for years afterwards, Hanoi was sending messages, well, you know, if you pay us $4 billion, we'll send back your men and things like that. And Washington never did. So my story is about nine men who, in the year 2010, managed to escape from Hanoi. Now, these are men who would be now in their late 60s, early 70s, right?
Hmm.
They escaped by ship. And they get as far as the Mediterranean when they realize that somebody is after them. They're not quite sure who it is, but the captain and other ship captains in the area are getting messages that there are terrorists aboard your ship. We want to come aboard. The Americans want to come aboard and take a look around. So the captain gets cold feet. And as he's going through the Straits of Gibraltar, sets the men down in a raft and calls the Spanish Coast Guard, which tows the men ashore on the Spanish side to the little city, very pleasant, called Tarifa. And the men insist on talking to somebody from the State Department. So a State Department man comes, Paul Clippin, the hero also of my previous novel, 11-9 and
yes,
the Terrorists Who Love Bonsai Trees.
I'm glad you made that mistake, because I have to think to myself, no, don't get those the wrong way around.
Yes, yeah. Right, right. And he comes down and finds these men, you know, asks them where they're from, and they tell them they're prisoners of war who have escaped. And of course, his first instinct is just to take them up the coast where there's an American naval base. But the men tell him, look, they're not sure what kind of a reception they're going to get because Washington has always denied that they existed. And so the diplomat puts them up in a little hostel and he investigates, sort of scouts the terrain for them. And the story is about then the diplomat trying to repatriate the men back to the United States.
Yes, indeed. And we won't say what happens at the end, because that will be a terrible spoiler.
Yeah, right.
So, well, I've got some questions to ask you about the historicity of this, because you've said about these various messages that were coming from Hanoi to Washington, etc., and you state them as if they are factual. I don't know, you see, this is not something that I've looked into in any depth at all. So is there really good evidence that US prisoners of war were indeed kept behind in Vietnam after the Vietnam War?
Yes, there is, Julian. There's actually quite a bit of it. And when you read about the efforts of Washington to deny it all and to cover it up and things like that, it's pretty obvious. I'll just go over a few of the main clues. Although I do put at the end of that story a bibliography of sources that had been helpful to me when I researched the topic. First of all, there were a lot of prison camps in North Vietnam and in Laos that the CIA had pinpointed as POW camps where Americans were being held. But when the 600 POWs, American POWs, came back to the United States, they were debriefed, and none of the men had come from about a dozen of those camps. And apparently what the Vietnamese had done was very clever, that they had run two systems of camps so that nobody of the group who went back to the United States could say, hey, wait a minute, I saw Joe Johnson in this prison camp, I was with him, why didn't he come back? So they ran two different systems so that they could keep the men, because they knew that they were going to have to keep them for ransom. What else? There were thousands of people who, in the exodus from Vietnam, told Americans when they arrived that they had seen Americans like out working in the fields in terrible conditions, really. The American government always said that these witnesses were unreliable, that they were just trying to curry favor as refugees. Some of the prisoners managed to carve words like in rice paddies with their identification number and so on. These were picked up eventually, of course, by satellites, spy satellites passing overhead.
Oh, yes.
And the Pentagon dismissed them all as vegetation and shadows. That's a quote, vegetation and shadows.
That appears, of course, in the book, doesn't it? You have somebody creating these words on the ground, by using poison on crops or something, producing these.
Right, they poured some oil on the crops.
Yeah, that's it, right?
What else? Two former defense secretaries, James Schlesinger and Melvin Laird, both testified to the Senate Committee on POW Affairs that they believed men had been left behind. And documents show that President Nixon had been apprised of the situation, that men had been left behind, although in public he said, no, all the prisoners have returned. What else? In the early 90s, there was a Harvard researcher who was working in a Moscow historical archive, and just by chance, he came across a speech given by a Vietnamese general 3 months before the signing of the peace treaty between the North Vietnamese and the Americans. And this Politburo general said that 1,205 American prisoners were still being held. The government, of course, the American government said, no, this document was planted in order for this man to find it. But Russian archivists said that the document was authentic. And then there was a Secret Service man who overheard a conversation between President Reagan, Vice President Bush, that's the elder Bush, and two other officials, talking, this was in 1981, 8 years after the end of the war, that the Vietnamese had given a specific offer, $4 billion for the remaining men. $4 billion, to give you an idea, would probably be somewhere around $22 billion today, which in pounds would be what? Probably somewhere around 17, 18 billion pounds. So that's,
right.
Those are the main clues.
Right. So the ransom, $4 billion or whatever it was, that's not just something plucked out of the air. There is some witness testimony to back that up.
Yes. You see, the Vietnamese kind of got suckered. In the peace treaty, it only said that the Americans would pay war reparations. And that's all. It didn't mention any numbers. The numbers were worked out by a committee separate from the negotiating committee. And they came up with the number $3.25 billion in cash plus another $1 to $1.5 billion, depending on different conditions. All of this was put in a letter signed by President Nixon and sent to the president of North Vietnam, Pham Van Dong.
How do we know that? How do we know
that North Vietnamese accepted this?
But how do we know that there was such a letter? Is there?
Oh, yes. The letter.
Can you read it?
The letter came to light a few years after Nixon resigned. And in fact, a few years later, in about 1979, there was a meeting between the Vietnamese and the Americans, and the Vietnamese took this letter and waved it at the Americans and said, what about this? And the American reply was that that letter does not have standing. It is not binding. That is where the American position stood.
Okay, well, I believe it's the case, and I'm not putting any weight by this, but I believe it is the official result of the United States Senate Select Committee on Prisoners of War, Missing in Action Affairs, 1991 to 1993, that, now I'm going to quote from, this is what they conclude. After they've looked in great detail at this, they say, no compelling evidence that proves that any American remains alive in captivity in Southeast Asia. That's what they concluded.
Yeah, there's a lot of very bitter commentary about what went on in that committee, and that especially the two main promoters of it, which were John Kerry, who was the president of it, and John McCain, who later ran for president on the Republican side, they basically, all throughout the committee hearings, just threw cold water on all of the evidence that the men were still there. Right. In fact, one fellow who was appointed to head the Pentagon Department to look into the matter, he resigned after 6 months, saying that nobody here is cooperating with me. Everybody here is stonewalling. You know, this is a farce. Yeah. In fact, this one congressman who went with John Kerry to visit a prison camp, this was in the early 90s, where apparently Americans were being held in an underground prison. They went into a kind of an antechamber, and John Kerry sort of looked around and said, well, okay, there are no prisoners. And the other congressman said, well, can we go through this door? And the Vietnamese said, no, you can't go through there. Later on, John Kerry said that they had made a thorough search of the area, gone down every hallway, checked every nook and cranny, and that there were no prisoners. And the congressman said, that's a lot of nonsense. It was just for show, the whole thing.
Right. It doesn't really surprise me. And actually, reading that conclusion makes me slightly suspicious, because if I read it again, no compelling evidence that proves that any American remains alive in captivity in Southeast Asia. Well, who is compelled? You know what I mean? Compelling
yes,
evidence?
Well, right. Right.
You're not compelled to believe something. And it also proves, you know, it's very hard to prove something. So, I mean, you could say, well, there might be reasonable evidence that it's highly likely, but, you know, it's not put in those terms. Mm-hmm. The bar is set almost impossibly high there. That's
yes,
what I
yes.
think about reading it.
Yes. You know, there's an interesting parallel between that and the committee that investigated September 11. Mm-hmm. A very careful reading of the document suggests that in many mm-hmm. places, the wording was very carefully prepared so that it would go around the basic questions, the basic clues of September 11.
Yes.
And the same thing was true of the committee.
It's great, isn't it? That ability to be able to tell the truth and to hide the truth at the same time.
Yeah,
I'm not saying that this is, because I don't actually know, although it's highly suspicious, I obviously agree.
Yeah. Well, nobody does it as well as a lubricious bureaucrat, that's for sure.
Indeed, that's very true. Okay, well, one question here would be, if the Americans are not paying up and they continue not to pay up, then, you know, why hold on to these prisoners of war? Why not just bury them? It's a bit of a horrible thought, but, you know, why not do that?
I think that the basic reason is that the men remaining in Vietnam as prisoners were sort of trophies for the Communist Party, the Vietnamese Communist Party. And in fact, one of the prisons that I just talked about, where Kerry and the congressman investigated, is right in front of the Ho Chi Minh Mausoleum. There's a great deal of evidence that right in front of it, underground, there was a whole prison prepared, and that many of the remaining men were there. But I think that the fact that they're trophies, not only for the top officials there in Hanoi, but also the men spread around Vietnam, maybe Laos, were sort of trophies to the rank-and-file soldiers. You know, we beat these guys, and this guy here that's in chains is the proof.
Hmm. Yeah, a possibility. I've also heard that maybe they were shared around other communist nations that were allies of Vietnam and sort of share intelligence and ways of working. I don't know whether there's anything.
I've heard that too. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. And I believe that Yeltsin, President Yeltsin, at one point said that there were prisoners of war in the Soviet Union.
That's right. He mentioned that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, people say, well, it's an awful lot of money to clothe and feed these guys. But you know, that's not really true. We're talking about 1,000, maybe 1,200 men. And they, of course, were treated very badly. Just to give them a minimum bit of rice and keep them in rags, you know, and especially the men being spread around so much. I don't think that was any big bother for the North Vietnamese. And the propaganda value of them, again, I think was important.
Yes, indeed. That makes sense. And one thing I'm not quite clear about is why the United States, if this is true, why was it so reluctant to pay up? I mean, these days, looking at that sum, even though it's a huge sum, with all the money that's been spent by governments, you know, you think, well, why not just pay up and get the men home?
Yeah, the money, just to give you an idea, would be about the equivalent of a middle-sized American department or ministry. So, you know, I wrote a long article about the prisoners of war when my book came out. And at the end, I sort of talk about that. And I think that at the end, it really wasn't a question of money. It was the fact that, you know, these are some very hard-eyed men with, you know, marine buzz cuts, narrow black ties, and they had lost to a poor third world nation, and they were not about to pay for the privilege of it. I think that basically it was a question of pride. They were not going to give in on that point. They had to give in on everything else. By the time Kissinger finally, you know, closed the deal with the North Vietnamese, he had given away practically all of their strong points, also because President Nixon was in big trouble because of the Watergate scandal. And I think it was just that they did not want people coming back from Vietnam for probably a period of years, reopening the wound of the defeat in Vietnam. I think that was basically the idea behind it.
Yes, and I suppose that's consistent with what you talk about, you know, the US military behaving like, I think you call them gods with a small g with respect to this. I mean, it became evident that, you know, this was an unwinnable war, but yet they carried on with it because, well, they were gods.
They had a godlike
hubris, really, isn't it?
A godlike attitude.
Yeah, and I suppose this is consistent with that as well. Why would you want to give in on this point as well? So that does make sense.
And it's no good being a god if you can't sort of, you know, ruin people's lives and say to some people, you die and you live and so on and so forth.
Yes, like moving chess pieces on a board.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, can you tell us something about this character, Robert Garwood? I mean, he does get a mention in the novella. People who are familiar with this whole scene will know that he's a very famous individual. He was a US prisoner of war in Vietnam, should have been released in 1973 under the Paris Peace Accords, but he only returned, I understand, to the US in 1979. Can you tell us a bit about his story? Did he escape or was he a collaborator?
Well, that's sort of the controversy that surrounds him. I think, and a lot of people who have, even military people who have studied the POW question, have said that Garwood is basically just a scapegoat and was discredited so that anything he had to say about prisoners would be considered just sour grapes. Well, anyways, Robert Garwood was a Marine private who came from a poor farm in Indiana. He was captured, I think it was in 1967, and he was taken under the wing of another prisoner who was a veteran POW even by then. And the other prisoner told him a couple of things. Number one, you've got to make yourself useful to the Vietnamese, because if you don't, they just let you die. I mean, they were in jungle stockades out in the middle of nowhere. Mm-hmm. And the second thing he said was that you can't make yourself useful if you can't speak the language. And so he helped Garwood to learn Vietnamese. And Garwood basically just took the guy's advice and he made himself useful. He repaired all kinds of equipment, did a lot of repairing old Jeeps, guns, rifles, all kinds of things. So the war ended in 73. He'd already been there for, you know, 6 or 7 years. And he continued in Vietnam and tried to escape. He passed a note to one guy in, I think it was 1977. That guy turned the note over to the Pentagon and they buried it. second attempt was in 1979. He passed a note in Hanoi to a European guy, a fellow from Finland. And the fellow from Finland played his cards well. When he got back to London, where he was based, he gave the note to British media, and it was published in The Guardian and in the BBC, and then there was no wiggle room. Here was an American prisoner who wanted out and was still in captivity in Vietnam. This after all of the years of denials of Washington. So what did they do? They had to discredit him. Mm. As soon as he got on a plane for the United States, he was arrested. Later, he was court-martialed for being a traitor and a collaborator. Basically, was just tossed out in the street afterwards with what they call a dishonorable discharge, right, which meant that he forfeited 14 years of back pay. Mm. He managed to get work at a gas station. And finally, Vietnam veteran organizations helped him get back on his feet. And he campaigned in favor of United States getting these men back. But of course, his reputation had been stained by the charges of treason and collaboration. And so that was the sad story of Private Garwood.
Mm. Well, obviously, I'm not saying that I disbelieve that story or think that he was a collaborator. However, listening to you, I could conceive of everything you've said as a story that he invented in order to hide the fact that he was indeed a collaborator. So how do we know that he wasn't?
Well, I suppose it depends on your point of view. It seems to me that a man who is in an extreme situation is going to do whatever he can to survive. And a lot of the people held by the Vietnamese didn't survive. In fact, the man who helped him out when he first arrived, he ended up beaten to death by the Vietnamese. And so I think you have to be a little bit understanding and a little bit flexible with what he did. He never killed other American prisoners. He never did anything terrible to them, as far as I ever heard. And in fact, some of the prisoners were quite grateful because he smuggled them some food and so on from time to time. So, you know, the difference between whether or not the guy was a collaborator or whether he was just trying to get along until he could find a way to escape, you know, it's kind of an ambiguous thing. But I think that you have to give him the benefit of the doubt. One thing that I think should be said is that a lot of the charges against Garwood were also made against other prisoners, but not a single other prisoner was ever charged and held and you know, taken to trial and everything. All of that was just erased and forgotten, and let's get this over with, and the men were just discharged. And that was all that happened, but not Garwood.
That is interesting, and that is suspicious. Is it right that Robert Garwood lost the ability to speak in fluent English or something? Is that right?
Yes, it is.
That's extraordinary, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, it is. You know, but it's a funny thing. I live in Spain here, and I have some British and American friends who go to work at a Spanish company, speak Spanish all day, come home, speak Spanish with their family. And after a while, their English starts to get really strange. And so, yeah, the idea that you can lose your native language, I mean, probably seems impossible to most people, but no, that's actually true.
Right.
People start to lose their English, but they hear enough of it, just enough so that it keeps them going. But you take Garwood, who for years, I mean, we're talking about probably a decade, where he was only listening to Vietnamese. And that's what happens. I noticed the same thing with Brazilian and Portuguese people who live in Spain. They lose their Portuguese because it's so similar to Spanish.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's difficult to believe, but, you know, if you say you've experienced that kind of thing, then, yeah, I have to accept what you say. It's counterintuitive, to say the least. You have a Christian character in your novella, a chap called Macander. Why did you put him in? It's intriguing that he's there.
You know, I don't put a character in for any specific reason. I put them in, and then if I continue to like them and they continue to intrigue me in the story, then they continue. Other ones get taken out. Macander is a black man from Georgia who has a very deep Christian faith. And after many years, more than a decade in Vietnam as a prisoner, he is allowed to live in a small village in the north of Vietnam, not far from China, and he is allowed to marry a girl who was just taken off the street, picked up by the police, was a prostitute. And he makes a life with this Vietnamese woman. I guess what intrigued me was that this is a man who made the best of a bad situation.
Yes.
And drew on his Christian faith in meeting the enormous difficulties of first being a prisoner and then being with this woman in a small village. And eventually he has three children. I don't know. I just liked that character. He was a nice contrast, I think, also to the other prisoners that you meet.
Yes, that's very true. He's a nice contrast to them. Maybe I'm reading too much into it, but what crossed my mind was that he's a contrast to the notion of the gods of hubris, of war policy that you were talking about in the book, because, you know, he's a believer in God with a big G.
Mm-hmm.
He's a humble man, and he makes the best of the poor situation he's in. The complete opposite of the gods of war, who are making the worst, you know, of the situation,
yeah,
pressing their own desires on everything that happens and everybody that's there. So I don't know whether that was intentional, but that's what came across to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the other prisoners are quite bitter about their experience, with the exception of Milner, who was a doctor and just continued to work as a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
His time in Vietnam, you know, he was satisfied with it. But yeah, McCander is... I think that aspect of him being a Christian also sort of informs his attitude of making the best of a bad situation, of not complaining and trying to find the good in people, in the good,
yes, yes,
in the good in a situation.
Mm. Yeah, it was a nice touch. Another nice touch, a very amusing touch, actually. It just jumped out of the page. This character, I think he's called Rossetti.
Yes, Rossetti.
Who bizarrely was able to take accurate measurements of things by just looking at them. So he would look at a table or something for 3 or 4 seconds, then he'd say, yeah, that's 3.5 feet, you know, and then somebody would go with a tape measure and find it, you know, he was exactly right. That's a bizarre thing that was thrown in, but I liked him.
Mm-hmm.
Did that just come off the top of your head, or does that reflect something real?
Yes, it actually did. I was thinking of a man who was a little bit crazy. Obviously, after so many years, they're a little bit touched, but who had this sort of odd ability, you know, sort of like you hear about people who are autistic, who have a strange ability.
Yeah, it was a nice touch. I enjoyed that. Okay, so let's just ask you a little bit about the form of it then. So, I mean, this is, you know, this is a novella. It's not a full-length novel.
Mm-hmm.
I think it could have been, actually. There's enough material in there. It's interesting enough. Why didn't you write a full-length novel?
Well, for one reason, because it's one person telling a story to others. So it can't go on, you know, too long, okay?
Mm.
And the form of it really could not be a novel. It's a little bit like Heart of Darkness by Joseph Conrad. It's a novella, and it can't be any longer because it's one man telling a story to others who are listening.
Yeah, so it's a story with inside a story.
Exactly.
And yeah, I can see that. But I mean, certainly as a story, I think it could have been a full-length novel, but I see you have the constraints of the form you chose.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the political backdrop to this, what should we call it, the framing story? Is that how you would call it?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So this framing story, you do explore the notion of a major rift in US political life, which, of course, we're seeing. But you take it even further. You have various states in the US seceding from Washington.
Mm-hmm.
What a little quote here. Quote, California, Oregon, and Washington legislatures having declared independence together. I think they call themselves Pacifica or something, do they?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
And somebody in the story asks, you know, when did this all start? And someone suggested, oh, well, you know, it started with Donald Trump. But Paul Klippin says, no, it started with Vietnam.
Yeah, when did the real crisis of confidence in government start in America? And it started with Vietnam.
Why did you choose Vietnam then? Couldn't you have chosen some? I mean, for example,
the Kennedy assassination.
Mark Crispin Miller. Yes, exactly. Mark Crispin Miller would have said exactly that.
Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm.
Why did you choose Vietnam?
Well, in the first place, regarding the Kennedy assassination, the doubts about the assassination didn't really surface until some years later. I think that, you know, they filtered through the population. It caused a lot of suspicion, but it didn't really sink in so deep because, after all, it was the death of one man. But with Vietnam, that affected the entire country because it was your brother, it was your boyfriend, your father who was being killed in Vietnam. Those people felt it very deeply. And people knew, especially with the end of the war, that they had been lied to, that the war had always been going badly, that there was no chance to win it, et cetera, et cetera. That and the enormous protests against the war, which really caused a big part of the nation to doubt and to be suspicious of the federal government. And that's, I think, something that I have seen grow my entire life, because I was born in 59 and I was delivering newspapers as a boy when the war ended. I remember specifically delivering the newspaper with the picture of the little girl running down the road naked, who had been, because of napalm and so on.
Yeah.
You know, after that, the feeling about government and the rift between the government and the people really started and has since then grown.
And do you think that the modern day situation is on the edge of becoming like you describe in the book? I mean, do you think it's quite possible we will see secession of various states?
I think it could happen. What's happening in America is that there is less and less that holds people together as a people. America has always been pretty shallow because Americans come from, it's a nation of immigrants, and they come from so many different places. But now the cauldron of passions is growing hotter and hotter. You have black against white, rich against poor. People don't trust the media to tell them the truth. They don't trust the government. So there is less and less that keeps people together. And I think the only reason that the nation hasn't broken out in actual civil war is that there really is no geographic distinction between the different sides. You find all the different elements in most every state. But I think that eventually there are people who are going to take matters into their own hands. And I think that the reason it hasn't happened yet is that there hasn't been a real economic meltdown like 1929 to cause it. But I think it's only a question of time.
Yes, and the political situation will be certainly different from 1929.
Sure. I mean, take a look here in Spain with getting the jabs for COVID and so on. Nobody has seriously questioned the need for it, and just about everybody has had their vaccinations. And I think that one of the basic reasons is that, well, Spain is just a much more homogeneous country. People are a recognizable people here, even though, of course, there are regional differences and so on. But there hasn't been any significant objection to the vaccinations, whereas in other countries, in the UK and especially in the United States, there's been enormous suspicion that the vaccinations are harmful and so on, which might be the truth. Those people might have the last laugh. Let's be realistic.
Sure.
I've had my two jabs, but I don't know if I would get a third, that's for sure.
Well, I haven't had any, so there we are.
Yeah. Well, you may have the last laugh, that's for sure.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the other short stories. Now, you have six of these: The Rainmaker, Pioneer Woman, Shocker, Alan the Newsboy, which perhaps needs an asterisk against it for those of a sensitive disposition, Pirates, and Exposures. Now, I will say that it's the last one I've not read yet, so I've read all the others. Could you just tell us briefly about those? I'll ask you about one in particular, but just briefly about them. What are they about?
Well, let's see. The Rainmaker is sort of a satire talking about the last meeting of the heads of intelligence, the many, many heads of intelligence in America. And it starts with the reported fact, widely reported, that the CIA went to Obama just a couple of days before the raid on bin Laden's house in Abbottabad, Pakistan. And they told Obama, look, we cannot be sure that he's there. And this when the CIA had this house under surveillance for 6 months. And so I start with that, and I have this CIA guy giving a presentation to all these different heads of intel in America and saying, look, folks, we've been looking at the house for 6 months. We don't hear him. We don't see him. If we just had one little recording of him saying, can somebody please pass the salt? It would sew the whole thing up, but we don't have anything. And of course, the CIA, Julian, is not a gumshoe detective agency. Okay, it's the CIA. And if they can't find one man in one house, well, he's probably not there. So anyways, the other people in the intelligence community raise hell and they say, hey, wait a minute, if he's not there, you've got to make him there, and so on. And the whole thing is sort of a satire on that. So
Now let's ask a few questions about that then. There's a chap, isn't there, in that meeting called the Rainmaker, who appeared in your previous story. Mm-hmm. Well, he was a Catholic priest, or a fake lapsed Catholic priest or something in the last one. Is that right?
Sort of... I changed the character a little bit. Right. I made sort of a younger version of him, a sharper version of him.
Okay.
In the short story, yeah.
Okay, so he's a bit of a shadowy character, a sort of deep state operative. Would you say he's a doer, as you had in the previous? One of these people who gets things done.
Yes, very much, very much. He's one of these guys who puts out, you know, these different operations in order to move public opinion one way or the other. Yeah.
Yeah. And I like the way he sort of steers the meeting, doesn't he? He advises them, but in a way that really is steering them to do whatever he's suggesting, really. And he fiddles with his pen under the table by taking it apart and then reassembling it with one hand. Why did you have him do that? I like it. It kind of works, but, you know, why does it work?
Well, I guess because it's just to show how bored he is and he needs something to keep himself awake during, you know, these long meetings. And, you know, it's not so much that you're writing a story and say, oh, I need to put in something that shows he's bored. It's just something that occurs to you when you're thinking about the character.
That's interesting. So you've done that intuitively, because immediately when I was reading that, I thought, well, there's a sense of, yeah, he's bored. He's bored because these people he's talking to are idiots as far as he's concerned.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
And also, there's a sense of control about it. By being able to put this thing back together and take it apart with one hand, it's as if he really is very much in control, and they can't see that because it's underneath the table. So I thought it was symbolic of the control he had over them.
Right.
So it's interesting that you did that intuitively. Works very well. Strange character, but it's interesting that he kind of represents the deep state. That is really calling the shots with regard to this, this operation.
Mm-hmm.
And you have some of the facts you say are in bold type. Every time you come across this bold type, you're actually reading something that is verifiably true.
Yes, that's part of the actual facts of the case, yeah.
Yeah, every now and again you come across that and you literally see the story woven around these facts.
Yeah, and then at the end there's a picture of Bin Laden there, the one that was published by the Defense Department of Bin Laden. It was from a video of him sitting there watching a video of Obama. Just to prove that this was, you know, in modern time.
Mm-hmm.
And there he is holding the remote control in his right hand when Bin Laden is left-handed. So anyways, the publisher gave me some trouble, saying it was kind of a pain in the butt to publish the picture when the rest of the thing is all tight. But I insisted, no, it has to be in there. Mm-hmm. And
I'm so glad you put that in, because I remember that video particularly. In fact, I have a copy of it on my computer, and I looked at it again a couple of days ago.
Mm-hmm.
And that always struck me as, you know, the intelligence community there, the US intelligence community, shooting themselves in the foot on that one, because it makes no sense to me at all. It's actually not so much which hand he's got the remote control in. Maybe they did get that wrong.
No,
but
it's just a little detail, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, it could be, even if you're right-handed, sometimes you use your left hand for things, so it doesn't really make that much difference.
No, but the thing that really gets me about that, and I've said this many times, is that I cannot conceive of a reason why that video would have been made except to supposedly prove that a Bin Laden was there inside that compound.
Sure.
I mean,
sure.
Why would Osama bin Laden video himself watching himself on television, on Al Jazeera or whatever it is, and never show his face to the camera?
Mm-hmm.
What was he doing?
Yeah, it's always a quartering shot from behind him, exactly.
Yeah, that's right. So if you never ask the question, why is this being videoed? Then, okay, so Osama bin Laden watching himself on television. But if you then ask the question, why is this being videoed? What purpose does that serve? The only purpose that I can conceive of is to convince us that he was there, in which case he wasn't there. So, yeah. I'm so glad you did put that in.
Yeah. As one of the characters in that story says at the end, you know, about the video, he says, isn't it going to be a little too obvious what we're trying to do here? And the Rainmaker says, well, yeah, that's true. But not many people are going to think outside the box.
Yeah, so there are a lot of cynical truths in here, which are very interesting to read. I mean, you have a number of these themes that come out in this that I'm really interested by. I mean, you have the contrast between truth and narrative, one of these cynical things that the Rainmaker comes out with. Oh, let me just read this bit. I've already mentioned it, but I'll just bring it out a bit more. Quote, all right. So Osama's not there. Great. Okay, fine. Then you make him there. The SEALs are ready to go. They've been practicing on the mock-up house for weeks. So you make him there. I like the way, you know, he cynically says, you make him there, not you make it seem like he was there. It's even more stark than that. It's a sense of sort of playing God with reality, creating reality for people. You make him there. I like that.
Yeah.
That was very well done. And also the sort of confusion narrative, confusion within propaganda.
Mm-hmm.
Reminds me of something I recently read in Jacques Ellul's book on propaganda. Where you propagandists, and they're not too bothered about consistency, because what you're primarily interested in is creating the effect in the audience.
Exactly.
So the Rainmaker, again, let me just quote from him, if you don't mind me. He says, let one version come out, then another, then another. Let the public pick and choose. Nothing stinks more than the classic seamless narrative. And I thought, yeah, that fits very much with what happened the recounting of that day.
Actually, I took that from one of my real models as a writer, John Le Carré.
Interesting.
And he talks about, especially in The Little Drummer Girl, about a woman who spies for the Israelis. You always want to be a little ambiguous. You want them to hunt. If you have a seamless story, that's going to stink.
Yes. And if you've got a chaotic story, then you have the public arguing amongst each other, not whether it happened, but what really did happen. What happened that day?
Yeah,
you know,
right.
So that which kind of affirms that something did really happen, or it really did happen. We just don't know the details. And that was really interesting. And I thought that particularly about, you know, the burial at sea. And then later on, we got that supposed leak about him, Osama bin Laden, being taken off to Dover in Pennsylvania. And then there's the question, oh, which one happened? Which was true? Was he buried at sea or was he taken back to the States, etc.? And I'm thinking, I don't think either's true. That was kind of set up to reinforce that, oh, yes, he was assassinated that day, you know?
Yeah.
It's interesting how, those sorts of confusion can actually work propagandistically. So lastly, you do have a few more of these stories. I don't want to ask you in any great detail about them, but some very amusing ones. Alan the Newsboy, particularly. I do warn people, if you're going to read that one, watch out when you read that. Presumably, there is no major theme that connects all these, is there? I didn't really notice it.
No, not really. Especially because there are stories that I've written over, you know, some years and finally have collected in a volume. I guess my favorite one of the six stories, besides The Rainmaker, I like that quite a bit, is Pioneer Woman, which is based on a woman that I knew as a boy and was always organizing the neighborhood events, picnics, and activities for kids, which the kids often is not resented a bit, but their parents told them to go. Then later on, some years later, because we moved away, this is when I lived in Ohio. Years later, I heard that she had divorced and had gone through a series of jobs and had ended up working in a very low-level job in a shop. And that always sort of stuck with me. And that's the root of that story.
Because that's what happens, isn't it, in that. I was quite surprised that she ended up like that. Quite poignant there, really, at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Nice collection. Nicely balanced there with the main novella. And an enjoyable read. And as I said before, I haven't read the last one, but I'm sure that will be enjoyable as well. Anyway, thanks very much, Phil, for coming on to talk about this. It's a great idea. And so this is a Legacy of Chains and Other Short Stories, which is presumably available widely, is it?
Yeah, it's on internet. Yeah. It's on, The Kindle edition is available on Amazon.
Yeah, so, and of course, yeah. I also recommend people read the 11.9 and Terrace of Love Bonsai Trees, which I very much enjoyed, and also remind people to go back and listen to that interview we had a couple of years ago. So thank you very much indeed for coming on. Your website, which has got various material on, I think we mentioned your poems. Yeah. Could you tell us what your website is?
PhilipKraske.com.
PhilipKraske.com. I'll put that, of course, in the show notes. Great to speak to you again. Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for coming on. It's been a delight.
Yes, absolutely, Julian. Let's do it again sometime.
So there we are. Don't forget that the show notes for this program can be found at The Mind Renewed, themindrenewed.com, via a link on the podcast page for this episode, TMR number 270. Just go to that page at the website, and under the description for today's program, you'll find a yellow folder icon with a little blue information symbol next to it. That is for the show notes. Click on that, and it should take you through to the notes, where of course you'll find various pieces of information to do with today's conversation, and not least how to obtain a copy of Phil's book if you'd like to read it, A Legacy of Chains and Other Stories. And if you do, please do watch out for the strong language. There's quite a bit, very strong language at times, by which I'm quite sure Phil is just trying to reflect real life, but there it is. And as I hinted at in the conversation, some of it is of a distinctly sexual nature, so just a heads up there for anyone who might be offended if you weren't warned in advance. So now you have been warned in advance, so if you would be offended by that, then don't get a copy of the book. Podcast music by the brilliant Anthony Rajakoff, Attribution Non-Commercial 4.0 International. You have been listening to me, Julian Charles, and my guest, Philip Kraske, and I very much look forward to speaking to you again in the near future.